Welcome to Composers in a Jukebox, a podcast that brings together a special breed of musicians in a conversation about their craft.
Today we are thrilled to be joined by the man behind the music for The Order of the Phoenix and The Half-Blood Prince, Nicholas Hooper, chatting about his work on the Harry Potter series as well as his new collection of piano music, Dawnings.
Hello. Nice to see you. Thanks for coming all the way down to darkest Oxfordshire and braving it.
I think it's a very cute village.
Most beautiful neighbourhood.
It's a nice village. And I'm lucky to be able to live in it as a composer. Even when I was doing films, I still lived here and I've always lived here.
Yeah, absolutely. And for listeners out there who might not be able to see us, but who are listening to us, we're in Nick's garden shed at the moment, which was this the place that you wrote the Harry Potter scores?
It was the place, yes. It all happened here. I can remember David Yates sitting in the chair behind me and jumping up and down where we got something right. and in the corner by Jolene was a massive safe, which they insisted I had because of the security with the films.
Yeah.
They had to be brought down in 8 separate parts by motorcyclists and kept in the safe.
Were there like security guards outside as well?
No. That was enough. It was just to make sure nothing got lost.
I see.
You know, and nothing went on the internet, obviously. The bikers were great. They'd come down and they were really nice to Rose, who was very little then, my daughter.
Aww.
And they'd like bring her sweets, you know, and I got to know them all really well. So, they'd turn up. What have you got for us? I'd say I got something, and then they'd turn up and it would be on a drive, they'd take it away.
Ooh, wow.
And they'd give me another drive, maybe, or something else, you know, but the film was basically split into 8 reels.
So right.
8 bits.
Yeah, that
so there was no chance of the whole film being on a bike at once.
Oh, that's a bit dangerous if something happens.
Yeah, quite.
Yeah, that's so fascinating.
Yeah. Actually, we need to mention something.
Yes. So Luke and Levant, who are typically with us and who do these interviews, they were absolutely integral in us preparing for today and for this trip to Oxfordshire. But unfortunately, they are kind of bogged down with a lot of work and are on a really intense project today. But some of their questions are still here and we'll be asking them on their behalf.
Yes.
Again, for listeners, we've known Nick for some time now and we've met him quite a while ago.
It was during the Film Scoring Society.
Yeah, in RCM meeting. And he's got a picture of all of us, including Luke and Levant.
That's right. My special picture, it lives there all the time. I didn't put it up for your purpose. It's always there.
Because,
That's so sweet. That's so sweet of you, Nick.
No, I'm just really chuffed that I used to go to the Royal College of Music and, there you are, wanting to know more from me and hear from me. And I'm just really, really pleased.
Yeah, actually. Yeah, really, we're really happy to.
Yeah.
So shall we, for a start, should we perhaps crack on with some of the questions?
Yes, we will. So what was it like entering a world that was already established by a number of previous composers? And did you particularly strive to establish a unique identity for the films you worked on?
It was interesting because, of course, following John Williams, who was really the chief mover, although Patrick Doyle was the one before me, but he would kind of set the pace in a way with his phenomenal scoring and music. And that was a bit daunting. And my first dream was, well, I'll just learn to write like John Williams. Well, that didn't happen. and actually, in a way, you could say it's just as well, because by default, I ended up with huge support from David Yates and the other two Davis of writing my own style. Which is why it was, you know, people noticed quite a marked difference in the style of composition, but then it went with the difference in the style of the films, because they became darker once Cedric was found dead. That changed the whole picture.
Yeah, so the use of Hedwig's theme, for example, the theme that was originally written by John Williams and is essentially the one that is constant throughout most of the scores. I seem to remember back then us talking about the idea that Hedwig's theme might not appear in the fifth and sixth films, and somehow it did manage to come up in the score at certain points, and even though it's meant to be a slightly darker palette of sounds in five and six. So how did that come about, and how did you develop upon those themes?
Well, Hollywood were very keen that that should be in, and I understood that because it's like the ident bit of music for the films. So David and I think we incorporated it seven times. I'm not absolutely sure. Somebody will know better about it for the score now. I think it's about seven times, or bits of it, during The Order of the Phoenix. And I think it was only about three times in the next one. So it had to be there, but in a sense I had to write my own music and not develop that score, that tune. And that's what they all wanted, you know. So everybody was happy in the end. And it was very interesting to just bring this in every now and then at certain moments. And there was one where I think it might have been the opening of Half Blood Prince, that I changed one note in the theme. Ooh. And it caused a rumpus.
Oh,
not during the while making the film, but afterwards. What's this man doing? Changing one note. This but actually, the reason was that it was to make it sound a bit more sinister. I think it done ba ba da bum ba da dum was a normal beginning, and I went ba 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 da bum ba ba bum. So I put just sharpened one note, which gave a feeling of, whoops, things aren't good. It's not, you know, it's all going to go wrong.
I love that.
Including the theme.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that because, yes, like, you know, in retrospect, I noticed that the note has been changed. But that was, funny enough, the way I remember Hedwig's theme.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, with the sharpened note.
Well, maybe he did it as well. I don't know, but I think in the original it's... But not with the show.
Yeah.
So what was your relationship with the director, David Yates, before getting on board on the project?
David and I had worked on everything since I met him at the National Film School due to a friend of mine who was also there putting us in contact and me finding he was in the next village to me. And I'd been looking for a drama film director because I was doing natural history films and I wanted to spread into drama. So we just worked together on everything as it came up. I was a real fan of Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing to do with the films. It was really to do with the books.
Yeah.
So I discovered Harry Potter in the late 90s and I was hooked. And I read everyone when they came out. I thought they were fantastic. And then I was walking along the street in Whitney, which is a local town, and David rang me up and he said, Nick, I think I've got Harry Potter. And I nearly fell over. I tripped over a bit of paving, you know, it was like nearly dropped my phone. It was amazing. So, you know, it was out of the blue, to be honest. I really was not expecting that. And David then wanted me on board because we'd done everything and he thought that we could make this work between us because we'd done so much before. And thanks to the other two Davids, David Heyman and David Barron, and then Warner Brothers, I was brought on board.
Awesome.
By degrees, yes. I had to prove myself and I had to dig up all the sort of expansive music I've written, but I'd never done a big movie, you know, which is a bit of a risk for them, but they took it, you know. Good on them, I could say. Lucky for me.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And at the start of the process, what was it like in the early conversations about the two The Order of the Phoenix, the first one that you worked on, and like, did you come up with themes and sketches way before, you know, during production and before?
Yeah, I mean, there's one we did, which I think was very much part of, you know, making sure I was on board with Warner Brothers, where they'd done a storyboard of Harry's entrance into the Ministry of Magic with Mr. Weasley.
Yes.
We went to Abbey Road and I scored it and recorded it before anything.
Ooh.
So that was done very early on. And then as we went through, we were always talking about what are we going to do next, you know. And it was a whole year of work because I was on board very early, which we'd always done before. Dave and I always just sort of talked early about things.
Yeah.
Just as well, really, because it, you know, it was quite a... I worked out I probably wrote 14 hours of music for that film.
Of which 2 hours were used.
Yes, well, that's right. Probably the best 2 hours, though.
Yeah, and what was he like as a director?
David is a kind and gentle man, very quiet. I've never seen him shout, you know.
Mm.
But he was extremely detailed and actually very demanding. So nothing would be just shrugged off and say, "Oh, yeah, it'll be okay." He'd never say that would be okay. No, it had to be bang on.
Yeah.
And the one thing that used to send a chill up my spine when I was showing him something I'd written, he'd say, "Well, that's interesting." And I'd go, "Oh, that's no good then." he would get, when we got things right, like I think one of the great ones was when we did, Possession, when Harry gets possessed by Voldemort towards the end of The Order of the Phoenix. He just got up and gave me a hug and he said, "Nick, we've got a score, you know."
Aww.
He could be really quite... very, very, very warm and very supportive about stuff, you know. But he also, I was used to having David on tap in previous films because, you know, we were working together with Mark, the editor. It was basically the three of us. We were let to get on with it. But, of course, with Harry Potter, he was forever being called away for meetings, for this, that. There'd be something to... we'd arrange a meeting and I'd be waiting there for 2 hours because he'd had to be called away to deal with... something to do with the animation or Warner Brothers were on the line or whatever, and he couldn't just come to me. And, you know, that was different. But when we did spend time together, it was always fantastically productive. Yeah.
Do you feel like Harry Potter has brought you guys closer together as people?
I think in a way it did, but I think it was also quite taxing on our friendship. And it was, you know, it was heartbreaking when I had to pull out of the next one.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it was quite a... he was terribly receptive about it. He was, you know, he didn't say, "Oh, my God." You know, he said, "Nick, you know, give me a hug."
Aww.
But I think it was quite hard for him, actually.
Yeah.
And it was hard for me, too.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Understandably.
But we since then, we met for walks and we have chats every now and then, catch up. I haven't seen him for a while, but, you know, he's in another world now and I'm here, you know, down the end of a lawn that needs cutting.
Would you like to go to the next
one? Yeah, I'd like to go to the next one. Yeah. So this is actually a listener's question. What were the differences in the compositional process of Order of the Phoenix and Half-Blood Prince? And did your process and technology change between the films?
Technology remained the same, unfortunately. Because eventually my keyboard packed up, the E-flat packed up on my keyboard.
Oh, no.
When I was trying to finish the Half-Blood Prince, which is actually basically due to my egg and bacon butties, and they used to drip just on the... E-flat key.
Oh, no.
But no, that aside, but it is true, I didn't really develop technology very much between them. But what I did do is I developed the way I worked. And with the Order of the Phoenix, we were finding our way, our feet, both of us doing our first big movie. And you can't get bigger, you know. So I was anxious to get a great piece for every sequence. And if you listen, they're all quite different, You know, you can tell the style's the same, but they're not thematically necessarily linked. Not consciously, anyway. So that would be the difference, because every piece had to be a sort of gem and to capture people, and you know, and it worked. You know, it was we were really pleased with it in the end. But with the Half-Blood Prince, it became much more developed from a few themes, and the most interesting one was in Noctem, which is not in the film, but was written. It was the first piece that was written for that film, and it was for a sequence with a choir while Snape is pacing up and down, working himself up to go and kill Dumbledore. So that came out, but the piece itself was so interesting for us that what we did was we used it as a sort of DNA through the film. So every time Dumbledore appears or there's something solemn, you get a bit of this chant that goes on through that, and it develops and develops until you get the journey to the cave, which is one of the biggest pieces of music in the film. Yeah. And that just builds and builds from that that idea. And then at the point where he's found in the courtyard, Dumbledore's Farewell, which is probably the piece of mine that's most frequently played anywhere, the actual tune of In Noctem comes in on the cello. So it's there all the way through the film. There are other bits where I've developed stuff from it. So it's much more like a symphony, I think, the second score, which is why I love it so much, because I'm proud of having been able to do that.
The coherence of it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It appears quite a few times, actually, when he's taking Harry through memories and, you know, talking about it. It just will dribble in and out, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of, you know, collaborators, what did your music department look like on Harry Potter?
Well, this is shed. The shed. I mean, I'm very much a loner, so I didn't have loads of people working for me.
Yeah.
I had an assistant called Alan Jenkins, who certainly on the Order of the Phoenix was able to help me a lot with the sort of technicalities of getting things ready for scoring. But on the second film, David nicked him. So I was kind of, I had a bit less of a team at that point. Mm. I had the conductor and orchestrator, Alastair King, who was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
And Alastair understood what I was trying to do.
Right.
And so he could be out there and be me conducting, because he was a better conductor than I was. And actually, with David, it was quite good to be next to him, picking up what he was thinking while we were hearing it. Yeah. It was a bit quicker than me being out there.
Yeah.
With David telling me over the microphone something that I wouldn't quite get, because, you know, you can pick things up in a room where you can't pick them up over a microphone.
Definitely.
Mm.
So then there was Cool Music providing the orchestra, which was just the pick of... We couldn't get the LSO, we just got the pick of the LSO.
Oh.
We got the pick of the BBC, you know, we got absolutely phenomenal musicians. And the orchestra, in its full size, was 110.
Wow. Mm.
So it's a big orchestra. And then there was just the fantastic Abbey Road thing, because Peter Cobbin, who was the then their main engineer, was so good to work with, and he listened to my mock-ups, which were done, you know, on MIDI. They were sort of samples, but he was really perceptive, because he was listening to the mixes I'd done, and he said, "Nick, you way you mix is absolutely essential." And we'd done some recording sessions. He said, "Look, we're not getting it the right way, the way you are mixing it." So we did actually go back and re-record some stuff, because he'd spotted that we were missing something, some of the original supposed magic that I produced on the sort of rather plastic music. he was brilliant. Alistair was brilliant. The orchestra, the whole setup at Abbey Road was brilliant. And then the people who printed the music, but that's it,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, I have to say that is quite a big music department.
Yes.
Well, it is in one sense. Yes. Yeah. I think to have a an engineer come mixer who is that experienced,
right,
was a real bit of a privilege and luck to.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always so fascinating because you know, as far as we know, every composer works in such different ways,
yeah,
and with, you know, with such different kind of configurations of collaborators and teams, yeah, and it's always interesting to hear where composers have, you know, work in bigger teams of people and where composers work in smaller teams.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, and for you, how did you cope with the baggage of all of this work, 14 hours of music and such a big film franchise?
Yeah.
Was it an easy process or
no?
Admittedly not.
No, but no, it was, yeah, it was scary. And one of the problems for me is, and when I compare myself to a lot of my friends in the film world, is they use assistants, they're happy to pass things to certain other composers to do for them, and I couldn't. I'm a complete control freak. So apart from the John Williams Hedwig theme, there's one other piece of music that Alistair, my orchestrator, wrote, and it's just the point where Lucius Malfoy raises the prophecy. And it's, dear Alistair, it's probably 20 seconds. But I couldn't do it, and he just got it absolutely right. He just knew how to do the swell, the build, and it was perfect. And of course, it sounds like it's mine, but Alistair actually wrote a bit. So, but it's all me, and it was down to me. But that's the only way I can do it, really.
Yeah, totally. And actually, Gillian, could I nick the next question?
Sure, go for it.
Because something just came to my head when you talked about MIDI mock-ups versus orchestral recordings and how, you know, they compare in terms of mixes. Do you enjoy working with MIDI? And, you know, because I think just kind of looking around in this space right now, there's like, you know, there's a grand piano, there's a little desk, which I presume is where you work on or write, I suppose. But like, there are no computers, and that's really fascinating. Not that I can see.
They're all under there. They're hidden.
There we go. Yeah.
there's a Mac Mini under there,
right,
with all the bells and whistles.
Yeah. But do you enjoy working with MIDI?
Not as much as I did, if I'm honest.
Right.
Yeah.
I think at that point I was into it completely. The issue of working with MIDI is that it limits. Well, it can limit the way you think about what you're writing.
Yeah.
So you're writing it so it'll work in MIDI. And limitations are good things. So I'm not saying it's quite nice because I've spent, you know, 7 years away from MIDI altogether, just playing the piano, playing the guitar, playing the banjo, you know, singing, and just no computer generated sounds. I've had this piano, you know, so inspiring to play. You know, it's got just a beautiful tone, and I can hear all these other sounds when I'm playing it. When with MIDI, it's just, you know, where's the mod wheel? You know, how do we get the sound to work like that? And it does produce very good results, and I don't deny that, but the process is quite mechanical comparatively. But in those days with Harry Potter, I was totally into MIDI. It was my means, you know, it was what brought me from the late 80s right through, you know, to the end when I really stopped doing films in the mid sort of about 2015-16.
Great. Yeah, it might be cool to kind of move on to perhaps more kind of specific cues right. questions and specific things and testing our memory here. So
yeah. And mine, and mine.
And some of them were actually questions that were kind of given to us by our listeners, which is something really special, which I think, you know, we've not always done, but we're happy to bring them here today.
Probably not the right key, but it came from the first point when Umbridge comes to teach in the classroom, and we wanted something that was sort of slightly scary, slightly irritating, slightly funny, and so I wrote five pieces that I thought would do the job, work quite well. And I thought, well, come on now, let's just push the boat out and do anything. But, you know, I just thought, that's ridiculous. You know? And then it sort of, you know, then we got a bit of the kind of ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum. It's not just a very kind of mad, slightly Eastern European, slightly off-key piece. And I thought, oh, well, he'll never like that. And the rest is history. And terribly simple. What is very interesting is it's terribly simple. And, you know, it seems to be the case, certainly in my experience of working on those films, that it was the simple idea that really worked. I mean, Dumbledore's Farewell is a very, very simple descending bass line. Mm. And just growing and swelling. I couldn't believe how well it worked in the end. Yeah. So, yeah, simplicity.
And actually, one of the themes that we were thinking of chatting about is Dumbledore's Farewell. Yes. And it strikes me as something, as you mentioned, you know, simple, and it is, you know, fundamentally kind of based on counterpoint, at least to my ears. But it's also quite a long, drawn piece of music that grows and grows and grows. Yeah. So how did you construct this long, gradual crescendo to some degree, and what were you what was the state of the edit when you saw that scene, and, you know, did you write the music was, to your picture, or did they cut it to your music?
No, it was, the picture was pretty close to being there when I came to do that, and it was one of the hardest ones, and I remember David Yates said, dig deep. You know, dig deep. He'd say that. And then David Heyman came up to listen to what I've done. And he said, I think you need to dig deeper. You really need to dig deep, Nick. You know, and I know you can do it, he said, because that's what they were like, you know. And it is just a very simple expansion. And that's it, really. That's all, and because of the way things, they reach up and, you know, get rid of the dark mark, the music naturally has to swell, and it just has to be that way. So I absolutely used the scene as scaffolding for the music. I think I could say that, honestly. Yeah.
I mean, like, that theme was, when you hear and you hear it, just close your eyes and hear it, it's just so sad as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, isn't it? And I thought was really interesting, if you look at the front of the film, it appears briefly.
Yeah.
And it was late, you know. I mean, well, not too late for the film, but it was later on that I was coming up with this. I remember, you know, we were virtually putting on the stands, you know, some of the bits at Abbey Road, and me thinking, gosh, that really does work.
Totally. Next theme?
Next theme.
Pick one. Whichever you like.
Actually, I want to talk about the jazz.
Mm.
The jazz cue.
I knew you'd go for that.
I wanted to ask, what was your approach to Wizards Weezers? Is that the correct pronunciation? What was your approach to creating this big band score? Have you, like, you know, played in a jazz combo, or, like, you know, jazz band before, or, like, composed for jazz?
Little bit. I mean, not really. I have played at Ronnie Scott's, but very, very long time ago with a group playing actually very, very experimental jazz. That was quite interesting. But I think the original temp track was actually a John Williams jazz piece.
Oh, really?
I think.
Was it The Night Bus?
No.
Oh, that's wonderful.
One
of the best pieces of the whole series. Extraordinary, that piece. But was it John Williams? Was it a classic? But anyway, it was a jazz band piece they put in. And my heart sank and I thought, oh, God, I can't write stuff like this. I have no idea, you know. but then, after much... it wasn't as hard to write as Dumbledore's Farewell, but I did... I came up with a thing that worked and fitted, and David really liked it. Everybody loved it. And then Hollywood arrangers got hold of it for preparing. You know, they're going to do all these arrangements for bands and all this. So everybody wanted, this is going to be a great theme. And then they put it out the film, which was, I was sad at the time. But it seemed to be, didn't have the total approval of everybody.
Huh.
Mm.
But very intelligently, they put they put fireworks in instead. They put fireworks in and it works. You know, fireworks works. It was a shame, you know, for me, because we took a lot of trouble. We actually got the. One of the chaps who was in charge of doing the printing of the scores, he took my music and simply, he didn't actually arrange all the notes are the same, but we just made it sure it was for the right size band, and then he conducted it in Abbey Road 2, so we got a completely different feel, completely different sound. And we got jazzers, and it was just fab. It didn't take very long, to be honest, once we got there.
Yeah.
It just happened. Yeah. Oh,
that's such a cool experience.
Yeah. That's like your favourite cue, isn't it?
Kind of. we have other very favourite cues, but it's like really hard to, like, you know, see, to rank, because they're all really good. And then I'm like, oh, no.
Yeah.
I don't know what to rank.
But yes, so this was actually a... it was 11th question, I believe.
It's 11th question.
I think it was.
Yes.
And this has got to do with certain cues. Like, you know, very much like Wizards Weezers that were found in the album but didn't appear in the film. So things like the end of Fireworks with the electric guitar.
Oh, yes, the electric guitar bit. That was so
that
cool.
Didn't turn up in the scene. And also Weasley's stomp. What were the considerations behind, you know, not including it in the film, but with them appearing in the soundtrack albums, it does suggest that these pieces of music were of some kind of significance while you were making the score.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was David Yates didn't want the electric guitar in the film because he felt... filmically, it was more effective to have the sound of the clattering of all the edicts, the rules all coming down and falling down, smashing. And he thought the sound effect that was, from his point of view, more effective. And then the build to the end felt more like a build. Mm-hmm. And you do get a bit of guitar at the end. So that was his decision. But and then it's the same, actually... with some of the other ones. What's the other one?
There was Weasley's stomp.
Weasley's stomp. Yeah, that was meant to be the end.
Mm.
The final ending. But he didn't think, or they didn't think, that I'd quite got it.
Oh.
Mm. And again, once again, they used fireworks. So it sort of... they used a good theme, wisely.
They really like fireworks.
They really did.
They did like fireworks. And people, I remember at the end of the film, people dancing out for fireworks, you know, in the cinema. So it definitely worked. The Weasley Stomp was, I was beginning to run a little bit out of energy there. There was another one too, when the try-up with Ron Weasley.
Okay, oh, I remember that one.
Yeah,
yeah.
Which is based on Dumbledore's army. Well, you know the that one. It was that was David's favourite piece of all. You know, he loved it. So, and he put it there as a temp, and I had to try and beat the temp. And as far as he was concerned, I didn't. So, I don't know whether we ever that one ever came, because it was recorded. I don't know whether it ever came on the CD or not. Not sure. I think he really did like some of those things and want them back in the final analysis. So he did, and. Of course, I was sad because I'd written these other pieces. But when it came to making the CD, Warner Brothers and them, they very generously said, no, it's your CD, this is your music. Oh. You put on it what you want. Which is why the guitar appears. Obviously, it wouldn't have been much good to have no guitar anyway in the middle of fireworks.
Yeah.
Just a load of clattering wouldn't have been much on the sound.
Clattering and guitars, that would have been spicy.
So I was, I could do that, I could do, I could put in, obviously, a Noctem, which is essential anyway.
Yes.
A Weasley Stomp, and Wizard Weezes. So they all had their place. And what was very interesting in terms of when I went to the premieres of both films was the fireworks with the guitar in appeared an awful lot in Leicester Square.
In Leicester Square?
Yeah, there. And went for the order, for the Half-Blood Prince, the Weasley's, the Wizard Weezes was played a lot.
Wow.
So they used the pieces that weren't, or parts that weren't in the film. At the premiere, which is nice, actually.
Yeah.
And actually very effective. What is also interesting is when, when I went to the cast and crew screening, it was the first time I saw the Half-Blood Prince, I was quite upset because of the things gone unchanged, Because what had happened, of course, had been a big delay. We were aiming for the sort of November time.
Right.
And James Bond came out.
Oh.
And so Warner Brothers delayed it till July,
right.
Which gave people quite a lot of time to what they call noodle. devastated Nick at the first, well, not devastated, but unhappy or sad about a few things. Then I watched it, a few years ago now, and I thought, it's perfect. Honestly, I thought, then they were right. At the time, I was so, I was floored by it. But now I look back and I think, no, it works. It's sad that those pieces, well, they aren't lost because on the...
Yeah.
Buy the album, folks!
Yes, buy the album!
But, it works, without a doubt. And it works as very well as a score.
That's I've kind of, just speaking as a composer now, it's kind of... And I don't know, you might experience the same thing, Jalene, but it feels like, because it's such a collaborative process, this business of writing music for films, and you're always dealing with notes and opinions about that directly affects what you write. But I do kind of feel like, at least for me, more often than not, I'm usually amazed at what comes out, having heard from different people and having assimilated their opinions, what comes out of that is usually much better than what I would have imagined prior to that.
Yeah.
And that's like, the power of collaboration.
Yeah.
And I, sometimes at times it does feel like, oh yeah, you're shutting down my idea, and it can feel shit.
No, well, I agree.
Yeah, but it's like when you have more brains involved in something.
Yeah.
And sometimes the director or whoever's the producer, they see things that we don't see because we see it in a more musical aspect.
If you are putting your whole heart and soul into making something, you will be upset when it's taken out.
Yeah,
it's
definitely
inevitable.
Yeah.
And I really was, pushing hard to get those things right and for them to be in.
Yeah.
So I was. But, like you say, collaboration actually, in the end, it works, which this did. It did work really well then. It gets it right.
Yeah, amazing. Totally. Yeah. And yeah, that's the power of movies, and that's the power of Harry Potter. Yeah. We're pleased to welcome back Nick Hooper with us today. We've just had a really wonderful conversation with him about music for Harry Potter, specifically about the scores that he's written for The Order of the Phoenix and The Half-Blood Prince. And now we're back with him to chat more about the works he's written for solo piano, solo guitar, and novels, which you've been engaging in largely in the past couple of years. Welcome back, Nick.
Yeah. Oh, right. Okay, here I am.
Lovely. Absolutely. So, let's go. Dive right in. How are we going to do this? Jolene, would you like to start?
Sure, I'll start with the new piano album. So, could you kind of tell us how this project of writing an extensive set of piano albums came to be?
Right. Okay. It's it started before I ever did any Dawnings. I wrote a book behind you called Scattered Chapters, which is the last book I've written. It was written at the request of Gordon Giltrap, who's a quite well-known guitarist. Well, very well-known. And he brought out an album called Scattered Chapters. Mm. And he said to me that he thought there was a story in every piece. And having read my books, we can go back to the books later, he thought maybe I was the man to write the stories. So I did, and there's 17 stories, and it's that scattered chapters. And one of the stories was based on a piece called Through Braden's Door. Braden is Gordon's grandson, and this happened when the boy was quite young, and he'd picked up the guitar. And his mum had not realised they'd got hold of this guitar, I don't think. Or anyway, they hadn't really heard him do anything. And she peeked through the door and found he was really finding his way around it. He was doing the most amazing things on it. It was just such a sort of extraordinary experience. So my story was that the mother looks through the door and is completely blown away by seeing her son doing this. And then she burns the rice. She has to go off and rescue the rice. and she goes back after she's rescued the rice. And he's going back over everything, and he's sort of working it out meticulously and making it more concrete, you know? And she realises that she lost the magic of that first moment, when he, for the first time, he did it. And the story is really was about the magic of the first moment something happens. So that, having written words for Gordon's music, I then came up with this idea, having got this piano, why don't I get up in the morning? Because I like getting up anyway, early, about 5 o'clock, 5:30 in the morning.
Yeah. That's incredible.
I'll
never be able to do that.
I wouldn't count on it. I couldn't do it when I was your age. So, it's something that's sort of come later in life. I'd get up and I'd do a bit of mindfulness. So I'd do a mindfulness meditation for about 10 minutes, 15 minutes. And then I'd sit and write a piece of prose or poetry for 15 minutes. And then I'd sit at the piano and play something leading from whatever poem or piece of prose I've written. So it started with a meditation, then it was a bit of writing, then record the piano. And I recorded it onto Logic, straight in, using two Sharps mics in my shed. And after a little while, I thought, I'd quite like to share these. So with the help of my nephew, Peter Bauman, who has been fantastic at organising things, websites and that sort of thing, we decided we'd do this format where I would release certain dawnings every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So every 2 weeks, starting was I think back in November, we've released 9 dawnings.
Are you still doing them now?
Every morning,
5 a.m.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh. It's part of my life at the moment. And it's been rather successful because people really enjoy to just have a short bit of writing.
Yeah.
And then they can hear a piece, or they can listen to the piece while they're reading the poem or the writing, which is quite a good way to do it. And I've really enjoyed it. It's the subject matter is things that concern me, to do either with personality things, nature, the environment, certain amount of politics, but really more related to the environment and my concerns about it. Mm. And just bits of beauty, and maybe I did one about what it was like writing on a computer keyboard and the noise it made. So it could be anything, you know, whatever. The discipline is taken from that whole story I started with, a little boy on the guitar,
yeah,
is that first word, that's it. I've got to go.
Mm.
I've come up with this word, it becomes a title, I've got to write it.
Yeah.
Wow. And whatever happens, it doesn't always work. But mostly it does seem to work, which is weird as well. And then it's the same with the piano. I sit down the piano, first note, get going.
Mm. So a lot of it is kind of improvised.
Oh, absolutely improvised. Mm. Straight off improvised. Yeah.
Mm.
It is. I mean, I have edited out of those, we got nearly the 100th, I think I've edited about 5 to take a horrible note out. It was a shame, you know. But basically they are fresh, straight off. They're raw. They are not beautifully finished, but they're hopefully sort of good to wake up to or whatever. Yeah. So far I think I've written 350.
Wow.
That's incredible.
Yeah,
that's a lot.
Yeah.
So, but you see, by that amount, you can tell there's quite a lot I'm not actually going to let out. But
yeah, that's almost a whole year's worth of, like, yeah, if you were to do it right every day.
Yeah,
it's nearly 365.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's more. I've been at it more than a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, we've had our fair share of improvisation experience.
Yeah.
Which is like just looking at that book, Scattered Chapters.
It does remind me.
Yeah.
So we had a improvisation
session
kind of together.
Yeah. The 4 of us with Luke and Levin.
Yeah. We actually just randomly come up with stuff. I was playing on the piano, you were on the flute.
I was on flute, Luke was playing the kalimba.
And then Levin was violin.
On violin. And we recorded it all in my shed.
In your shed?
It was. Which actually kind of looks rather similar, slightly longer.
Oh, yeah. We got a bigger shed than this.
No, but it was so much fun because it was like, you know, none of us, we set a timer for, I think, 17 minutes.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was an odd prime number. But we never expected it to turn out this well and to be such an enjoyable thing. It was one of the shortest episodes, but really enjoyable. And it was all of us just responding to each other, ended up being quite folk-like.
It is a really good thing to do. And I think for a composer, particularly a film composer, when you've got to come up with things fast.
Yeah.
Because actually a lot of the film music I've written is basically improvisation. recorded onto the computer and then tinkered with to make it work, you know.
Yeah.
But basically, let's see what happens. So great.
Yeah, such an energising process.
It is a great process. It is a freeing the mind, you know. You can find more about yourself through doing it. It's a journey, because we're all in this journey, and the journey, I think, is to find out more about who you are.
that's a great
beautifully
way to
put
it.
And
I've got one question, and then we'll go on to the... Yeah. So, 350 dawnings over slightly more than a year. How did you organise them into 10 albums?
Oh, I said. Well, this is where the big confession comes in. I have a beer at 5 o'clock.
Oh.
Not today. I'll be driving you, but normally I have a beer at 5 o'clock. And I'll sit down and I'll listen to from all over the place. They're not done in order. You know, it's much more to do with what's going to go well with what in a collection of nine. So that it makes it nice for a listener and varied and not just all the same frantic ones or all the same very slow ones or whatever. And I just sit there and think about it and order them. It's absolutely fascinating. It's like creating little albums all the time. And you call them albums. I mean, I just think of them as collections. Of course, they're all free, you know, unless I suppose Spotify isn't totally free. But otherwise, it's just you can pick them up and listen to them.
Yeah.
Why not? You know, it's a very fortunate position to be in. I don't actually have to earn the money. So I'd rather just put it out there. And if people want it, then they can have it.
We've thought about doing something that's kind of a little bit fun, also slightly cheeky, which was both of us, or if there had been four, each of us would kind of mention a particular dawning that's our favourite.
Yeah.
And have you speak about them, if you actually do remember what these dawnings are.
Oh, yeah. I should be able to manage it, yeah.
Okay, that's pretty interesting. Janine, would you like to
take it off? Okay, so I'm particularly drawn by the melodic theme in, I wrote it down, Right Here, from Dawning's Collection 8.
Right Here.
Gosh. It was a very short one. It was a minute long, but because how beautiful the melody was, I was looping it again and again and again.
Yeah.
It kind of drawn me, because I think like the high register melody was like something that I really like.
Yeah.
And it was
Right Here, Right Now. Is that one, isn't it?
It was just Right Here. Yeah. And
but I was thinking of the words. Yeah. 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 How did that come about? I think it was one where I'd got down a bit late and I wanted a cup of tea.
Oh.
So I thought, right, better get on.
And it sounded so pretty.
Well, yeah, but it's often best when you're not thinking about it too much, you know? Just do it. Because I make myself do it. That's the main thing.
Yeah. Trust in the instincts.
Yeah, and it won't always come off, but the more you do it, the more likely it just to come off.
Yeah.
It becomes like a habitual thing.
Yeah.
Which is
it makes me feel great the rest of the day.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
And there's another one I also really like. Sorry. Yeah. There's another one I really like. Sorry. Another one is Sundays.
Sundays?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
The block chords, the chordal playing style.
It is about, I loved it because it's quite nostalgic. It's about, and I am a nostalgic person. And I loved my childhood. You know, I was particularly lucky to live in a decaying, not very decaying, but Victorian mansion in Harpenden, Hertfordshire. Which is going cheap because it's probably going to fall down at some point.
Oops.
With my grandparents and my parents and my aunt at one point, and this big acre garden. As a kid, you know, it was just a dream. And that's taken from just remembering the lawns and so the music is all that kind of lovely. Oh, it's lovely to be back there. And it's lovely that you could have those memories. And the older you get, the more nostalgia can actually be not something to be sneered at, but something that can be enjoyed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a, what do you call those? Time boxes? Time capsules.
Time capsules, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
It brings you back in time. For me, it kind of feels like, you know, it takes me back in time when I was back home.
Oh, good. Exactly what it should do.
For me, that's. Because I used to like play in organs in church, so it kind of makes me remember like, oh, the organist or the pianist is like trying out different chords, kind of idea. That was me. That was my what I thought about it when I listened to it.
Yeah.
So wow, it's about nostalgia, and yeah, I got it. I got nostalgia.
I'm really, really touched that you guys are following this, because you're amazing musicians yourself with your great lives going on. You're still looking at my little dawnings. I'm dead pleased, to be honest. Chuffed. Yeah.
For me, my favourite one is one that's titled What's On My Mind.
Yes.
It's in the second collection, so presumably quite some time ago. And I like it because it's kind of, you know, it's a really affecting melody, but also it does feel like I can set the words What's On My Mind to that melody.
Yes, some of them are a bit like that. There's one that's definitely got to be a song that I will probably not release as a dawning, because that usually is a song.
Yeah.
And it needs singing. But I know what you mean. Yeah. What's On My Mind. Yeah, I was very proud of that one, actually.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of the words.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Particularly in that one.
Yeah, and it's a really sweet tune.
Yeah.
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 Well, that's great.
Seeing your piano, actually, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Have you actually thought of using different types of pianos for your albums, such as like felt piano
or upright,
or like you putting in a lo-fi effects kind of like?
I have used some effects on one or two of them, not many. Generally, take them off because they can clutter it up. But yes, but I do have an alternative action under the piano here.
Oh.
So, what we have in here at the moment is a modern action built so that I can use this also as a silent piano to play into my computer for MIDI. The old action wouldn't have worked, and that's from 1923. And it's still got the same felts. And when you play with that action, piano sounds quite a bit different. And actually, some of those dawnings would have been played, most of them, well, a lot of them would have been played on that old action.
Right.
Which is slightly uneven and slightly softer.
Oh. Yeah.
So it is a different sound.
That's a very cool effect to have.
Yeah, definitely.
The other thing is, when travelling, I've taken a ukulele with me. There are one or two ukulele ones you might have heard.
Yeah.
So when I was in Wales, I was using the ukulele, and also on the Isle of Scilly, I took it with me and played there, so that I still had something to play. And the ukulele is quite interesting, because I'm not a great ukulele player. I'm a guitarist, but I tuned it like the top four strings of a guitar, but obviously it's a fifth higher, and because I'm sort of not so familiar with it, it also gives me a chance to be fresh with it. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that's another instrument. Also, I have used the guitar one or two as well.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah. And actually, speaking of guitars, there is, and actually also about novels, because, you know, you've written not just notes on a page, but words on a page as well. And I've noticed that some of your novels are accompanied by pieces of music which you compose. So things like, you know, scattered chapters. And also there's a novel that you've written titled Above the Void, which I believe I've seen a copy of it in Levant's home yesterday, which he showed to me. Because
you're welcome to a copy.
Oh,
yeah. You both have copies of anything you want.
That's a lot.
Take a box.
That's amazing.
Take a box.
Yeah, and I think it was a guitar track that was
Above the Void is a guitar track. Yeah.
Yeah. So what is it that you feel binds written word and note?
But what binds it?
Yeah.
It's very curious, isn't it? Because the whole business of writing words came to me very late, as you can imagine. and it all came while I was working on Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. And I was getting to the point where I was thinking, why can't I just write my own story and then maybe write some music to it, you know? Yeah. But that the first thing was to write my own story. And how, now I'm coming to how they would link. Because I think it's easier to write the words first, actually.
Oh.
So the story, because that's how I worked. As a film composer, yeah. I got the story.
Yeah.
Then I did something with it. And the music is another dimension. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
The music's another dimension. So you have your story, and then the music will provide you with often a contrasting dimension, not necessarily fitting neatly with everything that the words do. In fact, you know, working with directors, we often would work on contrast or setting things off against them. So, but I think with Above the Void, that piece for guitar was very much about the sort of bleakness of it and the height, but also the beauty of the book. Mm. I've done, there's another one I've done, it's also as an audiobook, which is The Bird Being, which is a children's book. And that's got an audio book version with a second cousin of mine, Peter Morton, who's a very good actor. He did a fantastic job with that. But there's music at the beginning of that too. I wrote a piano piece, which is going well on Spotify, oh. I have to say. Bird Being. So, yeah, I do think that's it. For me, it goes in that direction. It's probably why Dawnings always start with the words and then go to the music.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would press, of course, Scattered Chapters. I didn't write any of the music.
No, it's funny because I'm not sure if we mentioned this just now, but the improvisation that we did as composers in a jukebox, we eventually released as an album.
Oh, yeah. We didn't mention
different parts, and its title, Splattered Canvas.
Splattered Canvas, that's great. Well, now there's a thing. There's another link, because... I was interviewed for a book. It was called Solo. And she interviewed me and she said, well, what do you do in the morning, you know, when you get up to go write your film music? Well, you know, what do you do? And I said, I throw paint at the wall, see what it looks like.
Oh.
Which is like...
Splatter
canvas. Yeah, absolutely. And that was the way... That is sort of the way I work, to be honest.
Yeah, that was... absolutely the spirit of what we were doing at that improv as well, literally throwing things at a blank.
Well, we're hoping to do another one, because we had a few fans were like, can you do another one?
Yeah, we're going to have to do it at some point.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think maybe just one last question. One last one from...
Yeah, Jane. This is actually from someone I met through a gig I did, actually. So she is also... she also is an author. She does many things.
Yep.
She has a question that she wants to ask creative types like you.
Yep.
Most people have difficulties with some stage of the creative process. If you have one, what is yours and how do you work around that, especially when you're working towards a deadline?
Throw paint at the wall.
There we go.
See what it looks like.
Easy.
Well, I think the for me, and I'm not sure it works for everybody, is... you just got to do it and keep doing it and keep doing it until it comes right. For some people, I think they do something and then they create a structure and then they work that way to get it right. For me, it was just, you know, a go at the thing again until it came right. But you sort of have to be persistent and not give up. That's hard.
It is.
And also you need to know when you've got it.
Well, Nick, it was an absolute pleasure to have you today and to be able to have, you know, the absolute privilege of coming down and visiting you in your little legendary shed.
It's my pleasure too, and I've really enjoyed it.
We are truly inspired.
We truly are, and thank you so much for being
the
generous person that you are.
That's right.
And for having us here. It's been amazing. I've had so much fun today.
And so have I. Really love meeting you. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Nick.
So follow us on Instagram and TikTok at Composers in a Jukebox.
We've got loads more interesting episodes cooking in the edit, which we can't wait to share.
Subscribe to our pages on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts to be notified of future episodes.